Happy third day of the Feast of Tabernacles to all of you. Thank you to the choir, to all the special music. Let them have their find their seats and give you time to finish the applause inside. We don't applaud outside, but if you're like me, you're applauding inside. You wouldn't be listening to me anyway while you're doing that. So do appreciate all the work that goes into that and appreciate what that adds to the service. In the Pittsburgh and Wheeling congregations right now, we don't have a lot of music. We don't have a lot of special music, and we certainly do appreciate it when we do have it. It adds a lot to the service. I appreciated Mr. Scorseth's sermonette, even though he took my introduction. I was planning on taking, I will approach it in much the same way that he did. One of the aspects that we most appreciate at this wonderful feast is that we talk about that amazing time that will come to earth when finally the earth will be at peace. In Isaiah 11, he referred to it. We can quote the statement there, "Neither shall they hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain." We look forward to that time when the animals will be tame and will harm no one. It's amazing to think about some of those things, and we all do at the feast. We think about those events. We think about what a change it will be. But the most amazing thing of all will that human beings will become docile in the same way that the animals are. "Neither will they hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain." There will finally, for the first time, truly be peace on this earth. If you'll turn with me to Micah chapter 4, we'll read one of the scriptures that we can probably quote from memory. You've probably read it on your own multiple times this feast season. If you haven't, you've thought about it. Micah chapter 4 and verse 2. Micah records, "And many nations shall come and say, 'Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem.'" And verse 3, "And he shall judge among many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." That's the title that I've given the sermon today, "Neither shall they learn war any more." That statement appeals to us very much as human beings. All of us have some knowledge of the horrors of war. We either have gotten it from reading about wars, from watching wars and movies about wars on television, or maybe we've spoken to someone who has been through war. I've never experienced war firsthand. I'm thankful for that. It's a blessing. It's a blessing that if you're like me and have never been involved in a war, seen one firsthand, we can count ourselves blessed among human beings for never having experienced that. Those who have experienced it often don't want to talk about what they have experienced. War is a horrible thing. "Neither shall they learn war anymore." We look at this verse and we think about West Point and the various military academies around the world, where the best and brightest young people go to be trained in the art of war, trained in strategy, trained in how to kill one another, trained in how to fight with our army against their army, to defend us against them. And that's going on all around the world. As we sit here talking about a coming time of peace, young men and women are being trained to use guns, to build bombs, to fly planes, to drive tanks, to kill other human beings. I could go into a lot of discussion and a lot of statistics on how much money is spent each year by the nations around this world to prepare for and to fight wars. I'm not going to do that. I think there's something more important about "Neither shall they learn war anymore" that applies to you and me. War has become just a normal part of man's policies towards one another. Karl von Clausewitz, a Prussian military officer, wrote a very influential book in 1832. It was published, titled simply "On War." It has become a manual used by soldiers in the European and the Western world since that time, since 1832, and is still used now to train military officers. In that book, he wrote, "We maintain, on the contrary, that war is nothing but a continuation of political intercourse with a mixture of other means." War, he says, is just the natural extension of one nation dealing with another nation. What we find is that war is just something natural for nations to do. But war is personal as well. War seems to be inherent in the human nature. Stephen LeBlanc, a Harvard archaeologist, wrote a book in 2003 named Constant Battles. He subtitled that book, The Myth of the Peaceful and Noble Savage. He had been an archaeologist. He was working with many others, studying various archaeological digs. And he said he became disturbed because everyone talked about how the ancient people got along so well with their environment and with one another. They were noble. They were peaceful savages. They knew how to work in the world in which they lived. They knew how to get along. What has happened to us was sort of the tenor of archaeologists that he worked with. He said he did not experience that at all. He said as he went on digs, everywhere he looked, there were signs of war. He said he would go on digs and they would talk about the peaceful savages and he would find burial grounds, mass burial grounds, where the war dead were buried. He estimates that of all the sites that he has studied and been on, 8 to 16% of the deaths were a result of war injuries. Think about that. Almost one-fifth, one-tenth to one-fifth of all deaths in ancient times were a result of war. He says that mankind has fought wars and killed one another since the earliest times. He has found, he believes, evidence of war in the most ancient human civilizations that have been dug up. He says it's a myth to think that there were ever people who lived at peace with the environment and with one another. His explanation is that the lack of resources always leads to war. No matter how small a group starts out, they live in an area, they have water, they have food, they could gather food, they might grow a few crops, they would hunt. But eventually, there would be too many people for the water, too many people for the hunting grounds. They would fish the rivers out, and there would be a lack of fish, and war would break out. It's inevitable, he said. The psychologist James Hillman recently produced a book, or wrote a book, to which he gave the title, A Terrible Love of War. A Love of War. The first chapter he titled, War is Normal. I'd like to quote some things from this. He says, is war abnormal? I find it normal in that it is with us every day and never seems to go away. After World War II subsided and the big conflicts that followed it, India, Korea, Algeria, Biafra, Vietnam, Israel, Egypt, war went right on. Since 1975, the globe has been engaged in wars in Haiti, Grenada, the Falklands, Peru, Panama, Colombia, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, in Lebanon, Palestine, Israel, Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, in Uganda, Rwanda, Mozambique, Somalia, Algeria, again, Sudan, in Afghanistan, Myanmar, India, Pakistan, Kashmir, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, Cambodia, East Timor, Sumatra, Iran, in Bosnia, Croatia, Kosovo, Ireland, Chechnya, Georgia, Romania, Basque, Spain. You may know of others, still others, only the participants know. He continued later, he said, this normal round of warfare has been going on as far back as memory stretches. During the 5,600 years of written history, 14,600 wars have been recorded. Two or three wars each year of human history. He continues later, he says, I base the statement war is normal on two factors we have already seen. Its constancy throughout history and its ubiquity over the globe. These two factors require another more basic, acceptability. Wars could not happen unless there were those willing to help them happen. He quotes the famous German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who in his book, Perpetual Peace, said, war requires no motivation, but appears to be ingrained in human nature and is even valued as something noble. Hence partly his title, A Terrible Love of War. Hillman says war is so deeply ingrained in us that our internal and community strife is the cause of wars against external enemies. He says, and I quote, thereby the inherent conflicts within a community that can lead to internal violence becomes exteriorized and ritualized onto an enemy. If you want to apply this to you and to me, think about what has happened in the last 20 years in our church, the Church of God. He says war, conflict within a group leads them to turn that on somebody else and find an enemy. Whether one exists or not, we find a way to turn our frustrations, our hatred, our anger against someone else. He says once the enemy is imagined, one is already in a state of war. Once the enemy has been named, war has already been declared, and the actual declaration becomes inconsequential, only legalistic. Could the state of war become normal, he asks, were it not in tune with something in the human soul? A force, a factor other than aggression and self-preservation, other than group bonding? He gets into James Hillman has, you may be familiar with him, he's written many books, he has some interesting, I'll use the word interesting, ideas about human nature and our place in the cosmos, but I want to quote what he says, even though I don't agree with some of the wording he uses and some of what he says. I think you'll see the point. This is what he has recognized in his studies. He says, perhaps we do come into the world knowing it all and that war is in us, not because of a fighting instinct, but in our soul's knowledge of the cosmos, of which war is a foundation. Near the end of the chapter, War is Normal, he writes, I prefer to swallow the bare truth whole, uncoated with justifications. The necessity of war is laid down in the cosmos and affects life with the unbearable, the terrible, and the uncontrollable, to which all measures of normalcy and abnormality must adjust. War is just the nature of the cosmos, James Hillman says. Learning war, as I said, goes beyond what takes place in military academies and the boot camps around the world. Learning war takes place in the homes of families and small children all around this world. Turn, if you will, to James chapter 4. You probably knew I would get there. James chapter 4. James chapter 4 and verse 1. James says, from whence come wars and fighting among you? Where do wars and fighting come? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members? You lust and have not, you kill and desire to have and cannot obtain, because you fight and war, yet you have not, because you ask not. Stephen LeBlanc says, wars break out because of the lack of resources. There's not enough in an area. There's not enough resources for everybody to have what they want, what they desire. And so wars break out. The word war here is polemos in the Greek, and it simply means to war, to fight, battle, dispute, strife, quarrel. It's a wide range of meanings to that word. It doesn't just mean what happens between armies on the battlefield. War has been a fact in the universe since the angelic realm rebelled against God, and Satan, Lucifer, became Satan, the adversary or the enemy. Turn, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 14. We'll see something here about war. Humans did not invent war. War existed long before humans did. Isaiah chapter 14, we'll just read a few verses here. You're familiar with them. Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 12. Says, how are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. We often refer to these statements as the I wills. Lucifer went to war against God because he wanted things his way. There were not enough resources in the world for both God and Lucifer to be in charge, to be number one. There were not enough resources. There could only be one number one. And Lucifer was in the attitude of I will. He wanted his will, unlike the attitude that Jesus Christ displayed at the Garden of Gethsemane when he prayed to God and he said, not my will, but your will be done. Satan said, my will be done. I will ascend. I will become like the Most High. I will be in charge. I will have the one top seat. I want it. I want to be the one who is in charge. Revelation chapter 12, and the battle in the angelic realm continues. Revelation chapter 12, once again, and near the end time, near the time of the days that we're picturing now at this Feast of Tabernacles, Revelation chapter 12, verse 7 says, and there was war in heaven. War is not a human invention. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Jesus Christ said in Luke chapter 10, verse 18, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. The battles in the angelic realm have continued, but they will come to an end as well. There will be peace in the angelic realm as well as peace on earth. War came into the human realm early on in man's history. Genesis chapter 3, Mr. Scorseth referred to this in his sermonette. I'd like to read a few verses here. Genesis chapter 3, again, picture, think about war, think about military maneuvers. Genesis chapter 3, verse 24, after Adam and Eve took that which God told them was not theirs to take, they stole from God. Genesis chapter 3, verse 24, so he, speaking of God, drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. There was one tree of life, a limited resource, if we want to look at it that way. One tree. God had told them not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They took of it anyway. God placed a soldier or multiple soldiers with swords, with weapons of war, to keep Adam and Eve from coming back into the Garden of Eden and to keep them from taking of the tree of life. You know, we may look at that as the first military maneuver, the first defensive position taken up in mankind's history. Because Adam and Eve may have had and probably did have the desire to get back into the garden and to take what was no longer offered to them because they had turned it down. They had taken of what was not offered to them because they had wanted that. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 3. And in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Eternal. And Abel he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof, and the Eternal had respect to Abel and to his offering. Verse 5, but unto Cain and to his offering he did not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. Cain was extremely angry. He was hot. He was furious. Other words that this can be translated. He was incensed. There was a hatred there. Why was there a hatred? Because Cain saw a limited resource. He perceived it as limited. God loved Abel. He didn't respect my offering. I want to have that respect. I want that resource from God. He didn't recognize that he could as well. God spoke to him. God talked to him. Verse 6, and the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? Why do you have that look on your face? And I think most of us recognize that look, can picture that look. We've seen it many times in various people's faces. Verse 7, if you do well, shall you not be accepted? It's not a limited resource. God's grace, God's love, God's acceptance is not a limited resource. There was room in God's heart and in God's love for both Cain and Abel. It had nothing to do with taking it away from Abel. Abel had done what he was supposed to do. Cain had not. Verse 7, if you do well, shall you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door, and unto you shall be his desire, and you shall rule over him. You shall have control over your emotions. You should have control over your desires. You shall have control over your lusts. There's room in my heart for you as well. You just need to do what you need to do. It has nothing to do with Abel. Verse 8, and Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. The first murder, or we can think of it as the first war. Cain fighting with his brother Abel over the acceptance and respect of God. He didn't have to do that. God was happy to love him and respect him as well if he would do what he was supposed to. And war came into mankind's realm. Verse 23, and Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech, hearken unto my speech, for I have slain a man to my wounding and a young man to my hurt. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. I'm even greater than Cain. I've killed as well. I'm not afraid to kill. I'm not afraid to go to war. I'm not afraid to get what I want and have my way. And as Stephen LeBlanc has pointed out in his book, warfare has continued ever since. You and I are called to be different. We're not just here to celebrate and look forward to a time when there will be peace on this earth. We're here to get a foretaste of it. We're here to practice it. We're here to begin training and to continue training to be part of the government that comes to the earth with Jesus Christ. Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. James Hillman is correct, and I believe in general he is correct. War is just part of human nature. War is something that is inherent in the way human beings live at this time, and the way human beings think. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 9 in the Beatitudes, a very simple statement here. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. All of us are here partly because we want to be called the children of God. We want to be part of God's family. Those of us who have been baptized and received the Holy Spirit are part of God's family. But we have to keep working at it to truly live our lives and be part of God's family. And eventually it will be an opportunity for all of mankind. But blessed are the peacemakers, Jesus Christ said, for they shall be called the children of God. That's what we want. That's the prize, shall we say, that we look for, to truly be the children of God, to live in God's family, to be part of God's family. We can only do that if we can be peacemakers. So we're here at the feast, again, to celebrate these things, to look forward to these things, to rejoice before God because we know what is coming in the years ahead, and we hope quickly. We're also here to learn so that we can become the children of God. We're here to learn to be peacemakers. What does that mean? What does it mean to be a peacemaker? How can we be peacemakers? We have an opportunity at the rest of this feast and the week that lies ahead to work on that, to be part of making peace and putting out the learning of war from our lives, so that someday we can teach others. Genesis chapter 13, I'd like to look at a small story that's given to us here in Genesis chapter 13. I don't know how much you've read it. It means a lot to me. I refer to it often. But it just seems like a rather inconsequential story, but I think it means a lot and has a lot of lessons for you and for me. Genesis chapter 13, speaking of Abram, this is before he became Abraham. This is early on in the relationship between Abraham and God. Verse 1 of Genesis chapter 13 says, and Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the south. So this was after Abram had been in Egypt. If you recall, he had gotten into he'd almost gotten the Pharaoh into trouble because he was afraid, because Sarah, his wife, was so beautiful. He said, if we go down to Egypt, you know, the king of Egypt will want her, and he'll probably just kill me so he can have her. So I'll just tell him she's my sister, and then he won't see me as a rival, and everything will be fine. The Pharaoh came very close to losing his life over this, because God was not pleased, because the Pharaoh saw Sarah and was interested in Sarah. And later on, the Pharaoh found out she was Abram's wife. So that had occurred. Abraham and all of those who followed him left Egypt, went into the south, it says. He and his wife and all they had, and Lot went with him. And Abram was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold. God had blessed Abram. Abram was very wealthy. Abram had cattle, silver, gold. He had all sorts of things. He had a lot of resources. Verse 5, and Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents, so Lot was wealthy as well. Verse 6, and the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. There was a lack of resources. War is on the horizon. Stephen LeBlanc would say, war is very close. Soon we're going to find mass burials, graves of mass burials of Abram's and Lot's men as they fight over the water. As they bring their herds through the day, as they find pasture, I got here first, I saw it first. You know, no, you've had enough, get your sheep out of the water. Verse 7, and there was strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled then in the land. There was strife between them. They were family, Lot and Abram. Lot was Abram's nephew. There was conflict between their men because there wasn't enough water. As they moved their sheep, as they traveled together, you know, your people got all the good camping sites last time. Give us first choice on the campsites this time. You know, last time we had to sleep on the rocks. We want the soft ground this time. And no, we were here first. We saw it. If you don't like it, go somewhere else. You can picture the conversations. You can picture probably fist fights. You know, there were black eyes in the morning. You know, we didn't get enough water for our sheep. Well, then go somewhere else. You know, we were here first. Those are the kinds of things that went on between Abram and Lot's men. So what did Abram do? Abram was the patriarch. Abram was in charge. I think I know what I would have done. I would have said, Lot, you've caused enough problems. Get your sheep, your men, your herds, your tents. Get out of here. Just get away. You know, you're causing trouble. We've been together long enough. You know, just move on. Verse 8, and Abram said to Lot, let there be no strife, I pray you, between you and me, and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are family. We're brethren. Why are we fighting? We're family. You know, are we going to have a war? Are we going to end up with a lot of dead people to bury? Are we going to end up with people with no left leg? Are we going to have people who've lost an arm in a battle? Are we going to see our women murdered, our children killed, children with no fathers, women raped? Is that what it's going to be between us? We're family. Why are we having this strife? Why are we doing this? We're brethren. We're family. Let's not have strife. Verse 9, he says, is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself, I pray you, from me. If you will take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if you depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. Abram didn't have to do that. Abram was the patriarch. Abram was in charge. Abram could have said, look, this land's not big enough for the both of us. You just need to move on. You know, we found a good place here. We like living here. You take your sheep, you take your tents, just move on. You know, you should be able to find something. This is a good land for us. You just need to move on. But he said to Lot, he said, you look around and you decide where you want to be, and you go there, and I will go somewhere else. I'll take whatever is left. Verse 10, and Lot lifted up his eyes and looked at the whole plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Eternal destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Even as the garden of the Eternal, like to the land of Egypt as you come unto Zoar. They stood on the hill and they looked out over the whole land. We can envision that being here in this part of the country. You can get up on the hills and you can look out over everything. And he looked down and he saw the plain of Jordan. It was green. There was plenty of pastures. You know, I'm sure they had been through that area some. He knew what was down there. He said, that looks like a good place to take care of my family, to take care of my herds and my sheep. Life will be easy. Verse 11, so Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. Abram let Lot choose what he wanted. Abram let Lot decide where he would go. Again, LeBlanc in the book Constant Battles explains that most wars, really, begin with resources when a resources in a region cannot provide all of the people there with a lifestyle they need or desire. So they begin to fight over. This is what we see with Abram and Lot. It could have very easily ended in battle. It could have very easily ended up with them having few enough people left alive that the land could support them. They wouldn't have needed to break up and split up because there wouldn't have been enough people left alive to deal with it. But Abram set a beautiful example of being a peacemaker. He said to Lot, he said, you choose where you want to go, and you go there, and I will take my people, my sheep, my tents, my silver, my gold. I will go somewhere else. And so Abram did. In verse 12, and Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent toward Sodom. We know later on, Lot may have come to regret his choice, but he got first choice. Abram gave him first choice. He took what looked good. He took what looked like the place where he would benefit the most, where his people would have the easiest lifestyle. That's what he took, and Abram let him have it. Verse 14, and the Eternal said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, to you I will give it, and to your seed forever. God had respect for Abram and how he handled this. Not only that, but the way Abram was. He said, look around. This included the Jordan River where Lot was dwelling. That land belongs to you. I'm giving it to you, to your descendants. Verse 15, for all the land which you see, to you will I give it, and to your seed forever. I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall your seed also be numbered. Arise and walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it to you. Then Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Eternal. Abram had a relationship with God. Abram offered Lot first choice. He was able to do that because he had faith in God. God had promised to take care of him. He was willing to let Lot have first choice because he knew that God would take care of him. I'm sure when Abram offered first choice to Lot, he knew what Lot would choose. Now, you and I know these things. If we work with our children, if there's two cookies left and one is large and one is small, we know whoever gets the first choice is going to take the large cookie. It's human nature. There is a, when I go through this, I can't help but think of something that I was told many years ago when there was just a small piece of cake left or whatever, and you have two children who are going to have it, and they're going to share it. The idea is that you offer to one to cut the cake in pieces, two pieces, and the other one gets to choose. And so you know what happens. It removes the strife because the first one is doing the cutting, measures very, very carefully. Those are going to be the most equal pieces of cake ever cut by human hands, because the one doing the cutting knows the other one's going to take the big piece. If there is no big piece, then, I got my share. We want our fair share. Abram didn't demand his fair share. Abram's fair share as a patriarch of the clan was to choose what he wanted and let Lot find something else. Abram let Lot cut the cake, and then he let Lot pick the piece he wanted. He did that because, as he said in verse 8, let there be no strife between you and me, for we are family. I don't demand my fair share. I don't demand to get equal rights. I don't demand what might belong to me. I will let you have the choice. I will let you have, an unfair share, because there should be no strife between us. Abram was a peacemaker. What about you and me? Turn, if you will, to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Paul has something to say about this as well. Paul here is speaking to the church in Corinth in this case, but as we know and as we recognize, when he writes these letters, when he gives these instructions, it's not just to the church in Corinth. That's who he was writing to specifically, but this is instruction to you and to me. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, he says, dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unjust and not before the saints. There's conflict between you, and you choose to go to the courts of the land instead of dealing with it yourselves. Verse 2, do you not know that the saints shall judge the world? And if the world shall be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? We're here to be trained. We're here to become, to remind ourselves, to spend the time we have here learning, but also to remind ourselves that there is coming a day when we are going to be called upon, as Paul says, to judge the world. Are we learning how to do that? Are we becoming more able to do that. Verse 3, he says, "Know you not that we shall judge angels? How much more the things that pertain to this life?" This is one of those instances where, you know, I'd like to have a discussion with Paul someday and say, why did you just throw these things out and not explain what you meant? Don't you know you're going to judge angels? Well, no, I didn't know I was going to judge angels. And please tell me about it instead of moving on. You know, maybe there's a 3 Corinthians and a 4 Corinthians, and somewhere he explained exactly what he means, we shall judge angels. Apparently they were supposed to know it, and he said, if you're going to do that, if you're going to judge angels, you know, why can't you just deal with a few simple problems between your, you know, within your congregation, between your group? Verse 4, if then you have judgments of things pertaining to this life, set them in judge who are the least esteemed in the church. You know, I don't know who he had in mind, least esteemed in the church. Oh, pick me. You know, I'm the least esteemed. You know, maybe he was thinking, you know, our preteens. You know, let the preteens do it. Let somebody do it who knows what's going on, who has some knowledge of God's way of life. You know, you adults are having difficulties. You know, call upon somebody you wouldn't think about. Just let them judge. Verse 5, he says, I speak to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you? No, not one that shall be able to judge between his brethren. To help resolve these conflicts, there's nobody in Corinth who can do this for you. You have to go file lawsuits against one another. Verse 6, but brother goes to law with brother, and that before unbelievers. Verse 7, now therefore there is utterly a fault among you because you go to law one with another. Why do you not rather take wrong? That's the point I wanted to make in this. If we look back at Abram's example with Lot, he said, why would you not rather suffer wrong? Why would you not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? Contemporary English version of the Bible translates this as, when one of you takes another to court, all of you lose. It would be better to let yourselves be cheated and robbed, but instead you cheat and rob other followers. Why not be like Abram and just say, you choose, you take what you think is fair, and I'll take what's left. Verse 8, no, but you do wrong and you defraud, and that your brethren, your family. Abram said, we're family, we shouldn't be fighting. There shouldn't be strife between us, we're family. And I know, as I stand up here, I've been through things, you've been through things, it's hard. Nobody hurts you like family. Nobody is unfair to you like family. Nobody is as cruel to you as people you love and you trust and you spend time with, and it hurts. But Paul said, if you want to have peace, suffer wrong. Don't demand your fair share. Let somebody else have the bigger piece, and don't complain about it. We're here practicing peace at the feast in Lake George, New York. Now, if you look at the history of this part of the country, beautiful part of the country, if you pull out the history books and look at this part of the country, it's famous for the battles between the English and the French and their Indian allies in the 1750s, and then battles that took place between the colonists and England during the American Revolution. This is an area that's had its fair share, maybe more than its fair share, of war. We're here at Lake George in this beautiful area to practice peace. How do we do that? How can we practice peace? How can we, with one another, practice peace? You can think of things in your own mind. I thought of a few things. Certainly, you probably have thought of these as well. What about peace within the family? You know, we talked about war resulting from lack of resources. You know, I could ask for a show of hands. No hands. Please keep your hands down. How many of you are going to go home to your accommodations after you leave here today, and there's going to be a lack of resources? The bedrooms are too small. There's not enough of them, not enough bathrooms. You know, kids sleeping on the floor. You know, 3 in a bed, whatever it is. We're in temporary accommodations. There's not enough resources. I know someone who has a very small refrigerator. I have some of their food. There's not enough resources. They were expecting a full-size refrigerator. You know, they got the college dorm model. So, you know, there's not enough resources. Those things cause stress. You know, we come, we have a three-bedroom place. Nobody said the bedrooms are going to be 8 foot by 8 foot. It's temporary dwellings. Those things cause stress. Those things cause difficulty within families. You know, you've taken too long in the bathroom. I need a shower. I'm not done yet. You were in there first yesterday. I woke up first. You know, we've all been there. We've all seen the, we've all practiced. I say we've all seen it. We've all done it. You know, I could tell you stories about myself, but I'd rather tell stories about other people. So. We can practice making peace and being at peace here at the conference center. Lack of resources. Count the chairs. Now, why aren't there more chairs? I'm very tempted to file a lawsuit here. You can join me in it. Mr. Martin, Fort William Henry Conference Center, whoever these chairs belong to, will file a class action lawsuit. There should be more end seats in this. There are just not enough end seats to go around. You know, why do they do that? Why don't they make every seat an end seat? You know, we need more end seats. There's not enough resources. It causes stress. Again, no show of hands. I put this in my notes. Well, actually, I didn't put it in my notes. It was in my mind to be in my notes. I didn't get it onto my notes. But this happened before the feast. But I have talked to people. I know of people. And again, no show of hands. But how many of you think in your mind, no show of hands, how many of you have had somebody steal a chair from you while you're here at the feast? I put my stuff on that chair. You know, I know if it hasn't happened to you here, it's happened to you elsewhere. You know, it's part of the feast. There's either twice as many chairs as there are people, or someone takes my chair. You know, can we have peace here at the feast? We're here to practice peace. Unfortunately, for us, the way we learn, the way we practice is to have trouble, to have struggles, to face lack of resources. You know, God could have given us a hall that had 450 end seats. He didn't. He gave us a hall that has an overflow room. Hello, folks in the overflow room. I was over there yesterday. It's fuller today than it was yesterday. I checked. God gave us a hall with an overflow room. And I was told there's a second overflow room if we need that. So we have what we need, but we don't have what we want. There's a lack of resources. What about peace with your neighbors in your accommodation? And I'm not talking about the neighbors that are partying wild at 3 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Martin. That's hard to have peace. I was talking to one fellow. He said, we woke up this morning about 6 o'clock. He said there were three or four people with speaking in Australian accents. He said they were using foul language and screaming at each other. He said everything they said was in a loud voice. I said, why didn't you get out of your hotel and go over and tell them to shut up? Well, I was joking. He was only one. There were four of them. And, you know, that's a good way to get in a battle you can't win. But it happens. How about being at peace in the community in which we live? I think there are people living here. I'm not sure. You know, go out on the streets. I think maybe we're the only ones here. But, you know, can we be at peace in the community in which we live? While we're here at the feast, look for ways to practice peace. Look for ways to be a peacemaker. And all you young people out there, preteens especially, you want to do something to blow your parents' minds? That's always fun. I'll give you something to do. Even though I'll say it, your parents' minds will still be blown if you do it. When you leave today and the subject comes up, where are we going to eat? Say to your parents, let my little sister pick. Let her decide where we're going to eat. And your parents will probably, oh, whoa, what's going on? Practice peace. It's simple things like that that we can do to practice peace, to become peacemakers. We're not going to change the world around us today. All we can do is work at changing ourselves. All we can do is work at setting the right example so that people may look at us and say, what are they doing? Why is it that they get along with one another? Why is it that they don't have the same problems we see everywhere else? I will tell one story on myself. I like to tell good stories about myself instead of the bad ones. I have to work real hard to come up with the good ones, but when I get a good one, I write it down. So, Years ago, I was working at a job, and they reorganized things. And, different groups, different managers. I got moved with a small group. And I got put in a group. There were just three of us, and we reported to one of the vice presidents. There were just three of us. I couldn't figure out why we reported to this vice president. And I couldn't figure out why I was stuck in a group with these two dunderheads. Let me call them that. I did not want to be with them. I did not enjoy being with them. I buckled down and tried to work with them for a while, and it just wasn't working. And finally, I went to the vice president, who was somebody I knew fairly well. And I said, Brad, I said, I don't know why you stuck me in this group. I don't want to be in this group. I've tried to make it work. Can't I move to this other group and somebody else goes with these two? And he said to me, he said, I know what you, I feel for you. He said, I know you want to be working with this other group. He said, I know you don't like these two fellows. He said, but I'll just be honest with you. He said, you're the only one I can put in that group who can get along with them. Well, okay, what do you do? I went back and we worked together. And that wasn't me. That's the Holy Spirit working in us. He didn't know that. He didn't know that I have the Holy Spirit in me. All he knew was he had a problem. He needed three people on a team. He couldn't split these two guys up and put them on both teams, or both teams would be a mess. And so he stuck me on the team because I could get along with him. You know, it doesn't make me anybody great. You or I, all of you have the same opportunity. Many of you have the same kinds of stories you could tell. It's God's Holy Spirit working in us. Learning to be peacemakers, one little piece of conflict, one little strife, one little quarrel at a time. We learn to be peacemakers. When a quarrel comes up, when strife occurs, when resources are short, we have an option. We can let the strife build. We can let it build till things are said and things are done that we regret and can't reverse. Or we can remember that God has called us to be peacemakers, and he promises to bless us for it. You know, Lot chose what looked good to him. He went down into the Jordan River, the river valley, because it was green, it was well watered, it was like the Garden of Eden. What a place to raise sheep. If you follow on with the story, not long after that, an army came through and took Lot and his men away. Who came and rescued Lot? Who came and battled against those who had kidnapped Lot and his family? It was Abram and his men who came and slaughtered those who took Lot away. It's not as simple as just let other people have their own way all the time. Abram knew when to fight and when to make peace. Abraham fought and saved Lot and his family from, you know, a miserable rest of their lives and brought them back, them and all their stuff. With God's help, he was able to do that. And what happened to Lot after that? He stayed in that area. It says that he pitched his tent towards Sodom, and then he ended up in Sodom. And then, of course, God destroyed Sodom, and Lot got out with the clothes on his back and his two daughters, and he lost everything else. Abram trusted in God and had faith in God, and Abram wandered that area for the rest of his life, and as has already been read to us in Hebrews chapter 11, he's waiting for his reward. He's going to get what he was searching for, but he's not going to get it until you and I are ready to receive the reward that God has for us as well. Abram had faith in God, allowed Lot to choose. Lot took more than his fair share, and God blessed Abram for it. Being a peacemaker sometimes requires faith that God will provide. Resources are limited, and so we let someone else have more than their fair share. We have faith that God will provide for us what we need. George C. Marshall, an American general in World War II and the author of the Marshall Plan to rebuild Germany after the war, said, "If man does find the solution for world peace, it will be the most revolutionary reversal of his record we have ever known." James Hillman, the author of the book A Terrible Love of War, has a much more pessimistic viewpoint of man and peace. In the final pages of his book, A Terrible Love of War, he said, "Wars will go on. They will not cease, and they will not change. The dead will fall as ever, At least we can imagine and therefore understand not all of it, but enough to step away from the delusions of hope and love and peace and reason. I want to repeat that last line. He said, at least we can imagine and therefore understand not all of it, speaking of our terrible love of war, but enough to step away from the delusions of hope and love and peace and reason. James Hillman thinks you and I are here celebrating a delusion. A delusion that someday there will be peace among humanity. Someday hope and love will triumph over quarreling and fighting over resources. Someday love will result in peace. He says that's a delusion. You and I are here because we don't believe it's a delusion. We believe it's true. We believe it is going to happen. War will continue to be the normal course of events right up until the time that Jesus Christ returns to this earth to set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. War itself will continue to be considered normal. I don't know if that struck you the way it struck me when I opened up the book, A Terrible Love of War, and the first chapter was called War is Normal. It really took me, I was taken aback by it, whatever that means, taken aback. Anyway, it struck me as very strange that we would say that war is normal. But that's what he said, and as I read his book, I have to agree. War is normal not because of the things that go on, but because war comes from inside of us, as James said. We're all part of the human race that has trouble getting along with one another, and that leads to war. But you and I don't have to continue to learn war. We can choose individually to learn to be peacemakers. We can be called the children of God. We're here to prepare ourselves to work in a new world in which we will be called upon to teach other people to make peace and not war. So let's make an effort while we're here at the feast. And don't forget about it when we leave the feast. Continue as we go home from the feast to make peace and not war. Because we have a lot to learn. So let's learn and practice so that we can be part of the reason that one day soon all of humanity can live in a world where neither will they learn war anymore.